The Best of British on LBC with Hampton by Hilton, making you welcome in Bristol, Birmingham, Liverpool and over 20 other hotels in the UK.
Hello, I'm Nick Ferrari with The Best of British with Hampton by Hilton, a series of one-to-one conversations with leaders in the world of business. Over the course of the next few months, I'll be speaking with the trailblazers who are leading the way in business and who are doing things differently. Go online to lbc.co.uk to find out more. And today I'm joined by Martha Lane Fox. Martha, thank you for coming by. I'm drawn to an article you wrote for one of the newspapers, The Guardian, a couple of months ago. Technology is a marvel. Now we need to make it moral. How do you make technology moral?
Well, I think it's very interesting that people think technology has a kind of neutrality to it when there are still people who are programming it, people who are delivering it, and ultimately people who are using it. So to my mind, ones and noughts, i.e. code, isn't as neutral as people imagine, and it does have biases in it. So I think it's really important that at this point in the development of the internet and the way that, you know, technology is underpinning everything in our lives, that we just make sure that we're doing things as well as we can do. And by that, I mean things, you know, as simple as working practices in tech companies. That's the kind of easy bit. But then the slightly harder things are, you know, how do you make sure that algorithms aren't biased? How do you make sure that they're not keeping out people that we've worked hard over the last decades to make sure are included? Very poor people, women, ethnic minorities, all the things that, you know, as a society we wouldn't accept anymore.
And in the piece, you talk about Britain possibly struggling to find an identity in a post Brexit world, and this is an opportunity. Expand on. I sense you are not a pro Brexit person.
I am not a pro Brexit person, and I, you know, campaigned in my own small way to try and help the Remain campaign.
You accept it is what it is now. You accept that
partly.
Oh, more on that later.
I feel as though the will of the people is a slightly overused and misunderstood phrase, but we can park that for a minute.
Yes, I'll come
whatever
back
to we that. Whatever we believe was right and wrong about the campaigns and where we've ended up. There is no doubt that Britain has to redraw itself in the new world. You know, there has been a phenomenal impetus into the startup space. You know, when we started lastminute.com 20 years ago, Brent and I had probably two options of places we could go for funding, and one of them gave us money. But now you look around, there's billions coming into the tech sector. There's masses of startups. Just, you know, here in London, every hour something starts in the tech sector. So it's fantastic. I still think it's going to be a challenge to take on those US big companies that have sewn up the internet. You know, Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon and Facebook own the web. So what is the role that Britain could forge beyond fostering startups? And to me, being at the leading edge of how we think about the morality of the internet is something that I think is going to become more important. And we have a tradition of being at the forefront of, you know, setting up justice systems, thinking about what the kind of rule of law means, you know, what does, to be a bit characterization of ourselves, what does decency look like on the internet?
I mean, that's fascinating because the parallel you draw, which is a really accurate one in a way, is that you've got the Swiss for luxury, you've got the Germans for efficiency, and you want the British for
decency and justice, I guess. You know, I'm sure that some people listening to this might think this country is not just, and, you know, it'd be easy for me to sit in my slightly ivory tower, having had all the success I've had in my life, and feel as though the world is equal, which we know it isn't. But I still believe that there is a central group of governance things that we do very well in this country. You know, we do have an effective way of running law courts. We have an effective way of operating government. We have, you know, a functioning democracy. And applying those things that we've learned over the last hundreds of years to the brave new world, I think, is a good challenge for us as a nation.
Are you of the opinion, then, that the referendum was merely an advisory?
I'm of the opinion that two things, I guess. Referendums are advisory. I mean, that's legally and constitutionally true. So it's less my opinion.
Parliament is not, therefore, does not actually have to act.
It doesn't have to, no. And I think it was just an enormous shame that it wasn't set up in the way that it is actually set up. I think there were so many bad representations and arguments made. But
Do you mean on both sides?
Yes, I mean on both sides, exactly. You know, I think the referendum wasn't clearly framed to people. And I think that, on both sides, as we know, there was much misinformation. But secondarily and importantly, you know, an in-out question leaves huge amount for negotiation. And I believe the world is not black and white. I think it's very complicated, and it's got more complicated, if anything. And part of the reason, and I see this because I've done a lot of work in many places all over the country that haven't used technology, and one of the things I've worked on over the last 10 years is to how to help people with no money or in very rural areas or in complex places to be able to enjoy the things I've enjoyed and others have enjoyed with the burgeoning internet revolution. And it's quite interesting that when you map some of those places with Brexit voters, it's pretty much a exact tally. And I'm not saying that if you're not connected to the internet you voted for Brexit, not at all, but there is definitely a relationship between feeling disconnected in your local life and feeling disconnected from the world and as though things have changed irrevocably for you. And I think that we should have had the nuance in the question so people could have a bit more of a sense of gradation about different options.
What you achieved, and you mentioned the fact it's 20 or so years ago, would you have been able to...
I was seven.
Yes, I had you down as eight. Would you have been able to achieve that in a Brexit Britain?
That's a very interesting question, and I have absolutely no idea. I think that there's no doubt that, you know, one of the incredible things about the internet is that you can start in any place, any location, any bedroom, and you can be all over the world. I mean, the platform nature of the internet, i.e. the fact that you don't need big shops, you don't need to worry about what's going on in the real world, you can do it all through your screen, means that you have access to theoretically the whole world. But there's no doubt that it helped us to be able to recruit people from all over Europe and to be able to go into Europe very quickly because of clement laws and regulations. So that was definitely a bonus. But also, you know, just unpicking one huge stream of our revenue, airlines, right? We did massive amount of work encouraging European airlines to give us cheap fares, and we got people to New York through via routes in Europe, the prices you wouldn't have believed that 1997-8. That would be much harder, I believe, in a post-Brexit world. You know, it's well known that the airline industry is going to take a lot of complicated unpicking to make it as robust as it is now.
So there's quite a business profile to you and background, I should say. How do you know, and I'm going to borrow something you talked about, an airline here, how do you know that a business might fly, an idea can fly? How do you examine it?
I really think it's incredibly hard to tell. I think personally, I go on probably three things. The first thing is the individual. In my experience, the idea is important, but the person who's about to execute it is 10 times more important. You can have actually pretty weird kind of idea, but if the person is tenacious and brilliant, they will work through it. They'll probably turn it into a better idea. They'll get brilliant people around them, and they may well be able to deliver something.
How do you tell if people are brilliant?
I think it comes down to a couple of things. Do they know their stuff? You know, have they done the work on their particular thing, or are they being a bit flaky? Have they got the combination of a big idea and a vision and can see where it's going with the rigour of looking at numbers, understanding a market, or if they can't do that, bringing people around them that can do that? So I think it's, you know, a couple of things. But I also think the absolute thing for me is just, would someone use it? Even if I don't think I would, can you imagine somebody that would? And if you find it very hard to do that, then I would proceed with caution.
If I was to invite five of your colleagues, former colleagues, into the room and say, what sort of boss is Martha Lane Fox, or was Martha?
I'm still a sort of boss, but I think I've got worse as well, not better.
What sort of boss was Martha Lane Fox?
Oh, I think probably they'd say haphazardous. I hope on a good day they'd say I was kind but tough. You know, I think...
Describe how can you be kind, but that seems a bit of a...
No, I know that might sound that it's a bit of a weird combination, but I believe very strongly that if you have to choose two paths, you should always try and be generous. So I'll give you an example. You know, I unfortunately, like everybody who employs people, occasionally have to get rid of people or fire people or, you know, move people on. And that's pretty much the worst thing that can happen to you, I think, if you're at work. And that's true whether you're working on a factory line or whether you're running a bank. It's tough to lose your job. And you should be mindful of that when you're the person having to make that call. So to my mind, to give people a bit more than they perhaps need, to give them a bit more time.
Do you mean financially?
Financially, or give them time, or just, you know, help them work through it a bit more slowly than sometimes you might naturally think. What's not to be recommended of that, because those are the tough moments in people's lives. So, you know, that might be an example. So I hope I would never shy away from making the tough decision, but I'd hopefully do it with kindness.
A lot of people will be listening to this who are running businesses and who have members of staff. If a member of staff goes off the boil, how do you get him or her back on track?
Yeah.
It must have happened to you. With
many times.
Not you personally,
probably
sorry.
To me as well. No, I'm sure it's happened to me as well. I think it happens to all of us, doesn't it? And I think I personally feel that one of the things I've learned over the last 20 years is that you know, you can't be at your peak performance all the time. And there was a sense back in 97, 98 when we started the lastminute.com that the way to be successful was to work 24/7. You know, the tech culture was very much always on. You've got to be dedicated. You've got to be on your email all the time. You've got to be checking your website all the time, all this stuff. And now I look back on that, it's absolute CRAP, sorry. But it really is, you know, people need time to regenerate themselves. They need time and space for ideas. We know that creativity happens in the down spaces, not necessarily the up spaces. So you've got to give people that capacity. So I think you've got to, you know, work out whether this is something that is a long-term problem for someone, like maybe they've just lost motivation in your company or in that particular role, or they're not motivated by the mission of what you're doing or whatever, or whether it's just that they need a bit of flex and space and maybe they need to go away for a couple of weeks, or maybe they need to go away for a couple of months.
Really?
Yes.
You could work, run staff like that?
I think you can. And I
Who'd
think,
be in HR?
I think that's part of the thing. I think HR is important fundamentally to a company, but it shouldn't sit in a separate department. It's got to be every manager's responsibility to be able to have the boldness and the creativity to look at their team. And
do you hold with this idea then of having meetings all sitting on bales of straw
not at all, although I don't like having meetings sitting down, because since my accident I like standing up. When I actually think our brains work better when we're moving about a bit, so I don't care if we're in bales of straw. I don't care about the bales of straw, but I do quite like the movement.
Right.
Walking meetings, perhaps a bit of a parody of myself there. I just think that culturally we're learning so much more about how the brain works, and people's brains work in different ways, and some people might work in one way and other people might work in another way. And as a good manager, if you really want to build a team of diverse voices and different ways of thinking, you've got to be respectful of that and not expect everyone just to sit at their desk for 8 hours a day and get the same results.
In the world of business, somebody once famously said, you learn more from your failures than you do your triumphs. Would you say there's some accuracy?
Oh, goodness me. So true. And it's maybe it always sounds a bit ridiculous when seemingly successful people say, oh, yes, I've learned loads from my failures. But I really genuinely don't think you can start a business and not be failing 90% of the time, because that's just the nature of it, right? So, you know, Brent and I bought companies that were a disaster. We went into countries we shouldn't have gone into. We hired people that were a disaster. You know, I remember a guy coming from France. We hired him because he'd run a huge, big travel company, and we thought we needed this sort of grown-up expertise. He arrived in the office, and I'm not exaggerating, he came up to me and he said, where do I put my mahogany desk? I was like, oh dear, this is going to be a big disaster. So that cost us a lot of money.
How long did that last?
Not very long. And then I started another business, Lucky Voice. Some people may know it. It's a karaoke joint. We've got quite a few venues around the country and the world.
Well, around the world, isn't it?
Yes, we have. And Dubai now. Yeah. And we've opened sites that have been marginally less successful than other sites. And they can
Where
be pretty
that idea
huge.
Come from?
It came from Japan. You know, I love Japan. I think it's brilliant. And I never understood why they had this huge phenomenon of going to sing karaoke in a private room, and we haven't had it here. So brought it.
Yeah.
And the brilliant co-founder, Nick Thistleton's made the business fantastic.
Yes, I was just chatting with Brent Hoberman, that you've mentioned a couple of times, just so all my listeners know to whom you're talking.
Yes.
Is there one venture that you launched that failed, that you really think was unfair, that it was really a great idea, it was a bit ahead of its time? Is there something you look back to that if you slightly tweaked it differently, it could have worked?
I think actually it's a bit more personal than that. Post my accident, I thought I'd like to spend more time doing philanthropic stuff and, you know, a bit less time just working in commercial organisations. And so I started my own small grant-giving foundation. I called it Antigone, after a Greek heroine. I studied classics, so she was someone large in my brain. But actually, that was a terrible idea, because the world doesn't need another small grant-giving organisation. It was replicating cost. It meant that a charity who has no money has to spend money applying to lots of different places, including a tiny organisation like mine. So that was all wrong. I didn't understand the market in a kind of slightly arrogant way. I thought, I'll do this my way, and actually I didn't know anything and I should have done it a different way. So maybe that's a good
idea. And the journalist in me is coming out here, because I just have to let people know you were in a life-altering road accident in Morocco, weren't you?
You
mentioned that a couple of times.
I was, yeah.
Seriously injured as well. How many years ago was that?
That was in 2004.
How much has that slowed Martha Lane Fox down?
Well, hopefully my brain only 50% and my body marginally more. It was pretty shocking. 2 years in hospital, 28 bones broken. I don't think I could have done much more to myself if I tried. And actually, I did get one quite good joke out of it. I'm the only person to have survived a dot-com crash and a real-world crash.
That is a good line. You're a peer of the realm.
I am. I'm surprised you're not wearing your crown.
Yes,
and I'm
indeed.
Not wearing my tiara.
How's that working? Are you enjoying it?
I am. It's a funny role. I'm an independent crossbench peer. So I applied. You can go into the House of Lords through a bunch of routes. You can be put there as a political peer, not something I would have wanted to do. You can be a bishop, again, not something that was open to me. Or you can apply in the Tony Blair started this. Two people's peers a year get selected. You're meant to have a particular expertise you bring to the House of Lords. And I have hoped that I'd be able to shout about technology in the world of digital and make a small impact on some of the legislative and choice, you know, kind of governmental choices we're making.
How much influence do you have in? Is it just a talking shop for toffs?
No, it's really not. I can absolutely appreciate why people think that. And I would have imagined that people on the outside look at it and they see that classic shot of the Queen coming to open it and they think that's what happens every day. The House of Lords is a hard-working place. You know, yes, the average age is over 65. And yes, there are some people, in my opinion, who should not be there. But the daily life and the work of the House is to go through the legislation that the government passes and improve it and amend it and scrutinise it. And of 1,500 amendments that the House of Lords suggested to the Commons, and they are only suggestions because we have no actual power, 90% got accepted last year. And those can be big deals in people's lives. You know, changes to the changes to the tax credit system, yes, for example. So that's one aspect. But then the other aspect is you're on committees. You know, I'm now a member of the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy, and that's another way of questioning the government. So because it's full of people who are a bit more, have a working life and who are part-time effectively, because it's not a full-time chamber, I guess, you have people there who've done incredible things, run big businesses, written amazing books, run the Foreign Office or worked in government.
Police services,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. People, you know, famous actresses through to dot-com morons like me. So it is actually an incredibly hard-working place, and I have been surprised by the level of integrity and hard work that goes on there.
And lastly, getting a bit political, you've nothing to do with your car accident. You've struggled to get across London today because of the traffic. I know. Could we perhaps see a political ambition? Were you going to run for mayor?
Well, you've managed to tease that out of me in a remarkably short space of time. And if any of my friends are listening to this, they'll be raising their eyes to heaven. But yes, in another life, before the accident, I would have loved to have thought about how to become mayor. I'm not sure I would have wanted to run as a political, particularly politically. I might have tried to do it in a different and independent way, maybe crowdfunded my campaign, but now it's just not a physical option.
What would you? What would be the first thing you do if it was mayor?
I think I would, you know, and I think to a degree they've all tried to do this, but you know, it's still surprising to me that across everything in government, that climate change and pollution and sustainability isn't absolutely central. You know, we have no planet if we don't crack this. I was lucky enough to listen to John Kerry give a speech at the weekend, the US Secretary of State, and he said, you know, human beings are dumb. This is the biggest market opportunity we have ever had in our existence. If we can face into this stuff and look at how to build sustainable energy companies, then we will have a future. And if we don't, we won't. It's as simple as that.
Pleasure speaking with you. Thank you, Martha.
Thanks for having me.
The Best of British on LBC with Hampton by Hilton, making you welcome in Bristol, Birmingham, Liverpool, and over 20 other hotels in the UK.